On this episode of Still Loading, what's your Enneagram? Everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Koval, and today on the show, this is actually a patron poll topic, something that you all, my wonderful patrons, voted for. We are diving into a game that you all voted for, and this game is called 9 Hours, 9 Persons, 9 Doors. And with me today to discuss, we're just going to call it 999 for the sake of ease. With me today to discuss 999 is game journalist Kate Gray. Kate, how are you doing today?
Hi, I'm doing well, thank you. I'm excited to talk about one of my favorite games.
I invited you on because, one, you've been on the show before, and I was telling you off mic how on our Phoenix Wright episode, I feel like I dropped the ball, and I want to do better. So I was trying to find an excuse for a while. I'm like, what game would Kate want to, like, could I invite Kate back on for? And then I saw a couple weeks ago, maybe a month ago now at this point, by the time we actually got to recording this, you contributed to that top 100 games of all time list that was compiled by, who compiled that again?
It was a bunch of the GQ writers that compiled it.
Mm-hmm. So I saw in a tweet you made that you included this game on your top games of all time. Like, out of all of them. So normally at the beginning of these episodes, we dive into personal histories, and my personal history of this game, I can tell you right now, my patrons voted on it and I played it. There's my personal history. There's not much more to it. So I would love to hear from you. You put this on the top games of all time. What's your personal history with this game, and kind of how, what makes you, I know we might be kind of, we might be jumping ahead with this, but like, what made you put this game on your list?
Well, I'll be honest, with the GQ top 100 games of all time list, I was feeling a little sassy. 999 is in my top games of all time list. It might be in the top 20 rather than the top 10, but I didn't want to just pick a bunch of games that would definitely make it into the list. You know, I'm not going to go out there and pick, oh, I can't think of any now, like Red Dead Redemption 2, because everyone else is going to pick that. It's definitely going to make it into the top 100. And I would just be kind of just throwing my vote into an ocean of votes. I wanted to vote for something that I knew either nobody or a handful of people would pick. And so I looked through, like, I don't actually have it written down anywhere, but I looked through, you know, my top games, my favorite games that I'm like, oh, you absolutely have to play this. And it was relatively easy to pick out 10 that I knew no one else would be picking, because a lot of my favorite games are just like weirdly specific, like cult favorite games on usually Nintendo handhelds, which are very underrepresented in these kinds of lists. So, you know, I put 999 on there. I forget what else I had. I know I had Minecraft. I was like, I don't know if anyone else is going to pick Minecraft, so I'm going to pick Minecraft just in case everyone forgets it exists.
Well, you write for Minecraft periodically still, right? Or is that?
I write for the website because the game doesn't really have any writing in it, you know, that means I get to cover a lot of the builds that people make that are just like insanely detailed. But 999 and a few of the other games that were on my top 10, like Return of the Obra Dinn, which did make it into the top 100, it was number 97, I think. And Fantasy Life, which didn't make it in, obviously. I think they're very special to me. They're very unique in terms of the way they handle narrative, which is why I like the games that I like. I like games that do interesting things with story, and 999 absolutely does. It is very weird in how it handles the narrative.
Yes, it is.
So that's why I picked it, and I still stick by the fact that I picked it, even if it basically meant that my votes meant nothing.
I'm happy that you put this game on the list, only for the fact that, so I, I guess to not even bury the lead, I did enjoy playing this game for the first time. I played it, like I said, for my patrons, and I I had some thoughts about how the different branching paths work, but we'll get into that as we go along. But my experience with this, I was joking around. Actually, what was it? It was literally in the last episode I recorded, which was Streets of Rage, which actually will be the episode right before this one. So like it's kind of perfect that they're going to be in like back to back in terms of when they release. And I mentioned how in games recently, I've been playing a lot of visual novels, obviously this, and I'm playing a different one, a mobile one called Simulacra for another guest spot or a guest spot coming up later this year. I hope I said that name correctly. And I've had a knack recently to get the worst goddamn endings on the first playthrough every time. Or like the bad ending, I guess, as it were. And apparently Streets of Rage has a bad ending, which is kind of why I was talking about it. But my experience with this was I got the bad ending right off the bat. I'm like, okay, you know, that happens. It whatever. And then I tried different things on my second playthrough, and I got the same bad ending again, because, even though I did completely different doors. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me now. So I ended up replaying this game 5 times in total to get as many possible of the endings as I could. And I did actually enjoy it because of how they designed the game and the mechanics of how they allow for the replayability mechanics. I really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I did find myself really liking this. I had issues with somehow kind of like the big twist at the end, which I'll put up a spoiler wall for that. We can dive into it and discuss it. Don't worry. We can talk about that part too. But some quick hits on just some of the fun facts I was able to look up. So the director of this game was Kotaro Uchikoshi, and the game originally released on December 10th, 2009 in Japan. It was later released about a year later on November 16th in North America, and has been ported to a number of different places now. Xbox One, PS Vita. Wow, what a late release for the PS Vita, 2017.
Yeah,
that's kind of nuts. PS4, Windows, iOS, all that good stuff. He was, when I was telling you off mic about an interview that I read of his, and they asked for his inspiration to the game, and he went into the philosopher, or maybe not a philosopher, I forget what he said, his actual bioengineer, maybe, Rupert Sheldrake. He's a German, I'm going to have to double check what he actually is, but Rupert Sheldrake, he's German, and he had in his theory of morphogenetic fields. And I thought it was funny because, you know, I'm reading this and he's like, I was inspired by this. And he's more than inspired by it. It's a major talking point for like 80% of the game.
Yeah. I think Rupert Sheldrake is an interesting person because his sons are both famous in their own right.
Oh.
Like he's this weird psychologist that's like, what if we're all connected and all this stuff? But his son, Merlin Sheldrake, is a mycologist. He's very, very interested in mushrooms. Mm-hmm. One of my friends loves his books very much because he writes about how mushrooms, in a similar way to the morphogenetic fields, mushrooms are all interconnected, right? Mm-hmm. Like the mycorrhizal network, which is like the fungal network underneath things like forests and things like that, that is potentially how trees communicate to one another. It's all very cool, right? And then his other son is Cosmo Sheldrake, who is a very weird musician who has a very unique style and is very big on TikTok, which makes him sound much less interesting, but he is very interesting as well. So like, they just sound like such a cool family with such weird interests. And to be able to say that your dad inspired a video game, technically a trilogy of video games, and like that's just cool. It's cool that people like that exist. I want to be friends with all of them.
You should make that a life goal. You know, like reach out. Is Rupert Sheldrake still alive?
That's a good question. Let's have a look. He's old, but he's alive.
Well, yeah. There you go. You gotta start now before he. I mean, that's a little morbid to say, but before he passes,
I'll call him up. Yeah, I mean, he's British. We all know one another, right?
Yeah. he's British, not German. My bad. I could have sworn I read it as German. That's okay. The other idea that he had was the theme. You know, it's a theme in a lot of his games. The interviewer referenced Uchikoshi's previous game, which I'm blanking on the name of off the top of my head. I'm going to try to find it right now. It's Ever 17. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. Ever 17, which I have never heard of. Have you ever played Ever 17?
I have not. No, I sort of started with 999 and mm-hmm. then played Uchikoshi's other games. Not all of them, but a lot of them. So, yeah, I haven't really explored his older stuff because I think 999 is really when he sort of perfected it.
Well, apparently, according to the interviewer, Ever 17 also deals with the idea of characters being trapped and having to escape mm-hmm. from something.
Okay.
And he talks about it in the interview, which this is why I was saying, like, he goes places in this. I was telling you off, Mike, this interview just goes places because they're like, well, you know, what inspired you know, what are some of the themes? And he talks about Rupert Sheldrake. I'm like, okay, mm-hmm. that's not like, you're not alluding to it. You're on the nose. Like, it's just, it's right there. And then the other thing was the idea of characters being trapped. And according to him, it comes from humanity's innate desire to return to their mother's womb. But also, they have another innate desire to rise above their situation and escape from things. So the idea that, you know, you want to go into your mother's room to kind of, it's, you know, like a very, oh my gosh, why am I, but introvert type of idea where, you know, you like being safe and secure and this and that, but then you also want to break out of it. And I just thought that I'm like, that's, I don't know. I've never really, I didn't play 999 feeling like this is like my mom's womb. I don't see it in there. I mean,
see those themes in Uchikoshi's later work.
Okay.
In AI, the AI games, I've only played the Somnium Files because I have a backlog and I haven't got to the sequel Nirvana Initiative yet, but there is absolutely this sort of like vibe of sort of mothers and female characters and wanting to be safe. And you can see some of that in 999 and Virtue's Last Reward, which is the sequel, and then Zero Time Dilemma, that there is this sort of through line of like very maternal characters, but it's handled in a creepy way. It's handled in a creepy way in AI as well. Like as much as I love Uchikoshi games, he is very much like, it's a bunch of serious, very well-written stuff. And then it's a woman wearing a very small bikini being like, ooh, I'm making weird jokes about sex. And it's his quirk. I think you have to sort of just take it in stride because it's not malicious as far as I can tell. It's not overtly misogynistic. It's this like, you know, appreciation, I guess, of the female form that he just can't help putting in there. And I don't know, it's almost charmingly old-fashioned.
I see what you're saying, even with 999 too, like like Lotus specifically, the character of Lotus, where she's basically just jiggle physics in most of the game. And what's strange though is all from what I remember of all the dialogue, the more overt sexual innuendos and dialogue is geared towards Clover, the younger girl, which makes made me really uncomfortable with them making all these like sexual jokes about Clover, mm-hmm. and then Lotus is the one who's barely wearing any clothes. It was a very strange like dichotomy, I guess, or for lack of a better word, of between that.
Yeah, and in Uchikoshi's defense, the main character of the game is a creep. He's a creep. And you're not necessarily supposed to agree with him. He's constantly making comments or thinking kind of, you know, pervy things about the characters. Mm-hmm. And either they're just like, what do you mean? And he's like, nothing. Or they go, ew, don't do that, you weirdo. And, you know, Lotus, she's extremely sexualized in the way that she is drawn, but she's also extremely smart and very useful. Yes. And kind of mean, which is not necessarily what you would expect of a character that's sort of portrayed like that. So, like, I think that it is still subversive. I think that it's lewd. Like, there's a lot of characters in Uchikoshi's games that are like jiggle physics, like you put it. But they're also allowed to have agency. They're allowed to have personalities. And so I really can't hold it against him too much, because, like, he might like big boobs, but he doesn't just make them big boobs on legs. That's not
their defining trait.
Exactly. Like, it's their most obvious trait when you look at them, but they're still fully fleshed out characters.
No pun intended.
In a lot of ways, like, Lotus doesn't ever really mention that she's wearing next to nothing, I think. Like, I can't imagine going outside in an outfit like that and not constantly talking about how uncomfortable and cold I was. But
especially, you know, like, if, like, where the, well, I guess this, never mind. I was about to say where they're located, but I was about to spoil something, which I'll wait for the spoiler wall. No, but you're right. And I think Lotus, specifically the character of her, she's the most interesting in it, yeah, in my opinion. Okay. I think followed by, who did I like? Seven, I also really enjoyed, just because
I was going to say Seven.
He's, you know, he's the big tough brute guy, but he's not just like, it would be so easy to fall under the trope of the big tough guy who's actually a teddy bear, but he kind of balances it really well between the two, where he's not quite, he's still that big tough guy, but he's also not quite that teddy bear. And I really enjoyed that characterization, because it didn't fall into a trope. And likewise, like you said, like with Lotus, you would expect, because of the way she's dressed, she would fall into a trope, but doesn't. Mm-hmm. And that's what it, none of the characters really seem to fall into tropes, and he does a good job at subverting your expectations.
Yes.
And what I like, though, is that at the, I guess to put a little bit of some, or excuse me, to add some context for the listeners who have never played this game, the premise of the game is you play as a character named Junpei, who's been captured by someone you don't know, someone in a gas mask, that has knocked him out, and he awakens on a ship, and in like a ship's quarters type of thing, like a little in a room with like bunk beds and stuff. And the gameplay kind of consists of you choosing different dialogue options, and then there's little mini puzzle sections that are kind of like escape rooms that you use to escape each area, and you have to explore around the room, tap on different things with your stylus, get different items, use them, combine them, all these different things. And then you escape, and then you meet other characters, and you have to try to figure out why you're put there. And you learn that you were put there by this character named Zero, they have like kidnapped you to participate in this thing called the Nonary game. And you have 9 hours to get out. You have to find door number 9. There's like doors with like red paint on them, numbered one through nine. There are some gimmicks as to how to open the doors, which we'll go into in a little bit, but for all intents and purposes, you are trying to figure out why you were put there, who is running the Nonary game, and you have to escape in 9 hours, otherwise the boat you're on will sink to the ocean below, and then you die. And if you kind of go against Zero's rules, there's also a bomb inside of you and that will blow up if you don't follow Zero's rules. And so it's this kind of, it's not quite Saw, but it kind of gives me those vibes of, like, you know, being trapped in this deadly game and you have to find a way to escape. For, you know, the Saw movies are all about inflicting the people as much pain as possible. This is more of like an experiment of the human condition, but still, that's kind of the whole premise. So you play as Junpei and you have to figure out, who did this? Why are you here? How do you get out? And can you survive? Mm-hmm. And that is the basic premise of the game. So all these different characters are characters that are trapped there with you, and they all have different interesting traits. And in fact, Uchikoshi designed each of their personalities to be based on the Enneagrams, hence why I mentioned it during the little intro piece. The 9 different Enneagram types, according to him, I have no idea if this is accurate. Kate, do you know anything about Enneagram?
I know that it influenced the game. I know that it's sort of like the Myers-Briggs kind of thing where everybody has a personality type. I think you can be a combination of a bunch of them. I don't know the Enneagram. I feel like I took it once and I was like 7 or something like that, but I forget. I don't remember anything.
Well, at least in the interview that I read, the 9 different Enneagram, like, it basically, Enneagram listeners, is like a way to classify people's personality types into 9 different categories. Now, you're not necessarily strictly one or the other. You can have a combination of these. Uchikoshi himself said is a combo of number 4 and 5, which number 4 is the individualist and number 5 is the investigator. Those two personality types, and he makes a joke that it makes him sound like a dick, the individualist investigator. Which that was pretty funny to me. But number 1 is the reformer. Number 2 is the helper. Number 3 is the achiever. 4, individualist. 5, investigator. 6, the loyalist. 7, the enthusiast. 8, the challenger. And 9 is peacemaker. And I don't know if exactly, like, you know, because there's 9 characters that you meet, and they're number 1 through 9. They kind of give themselves like aliases based off of which number they were assigned. So like 1 is ace, because, you know, ace of cards, you know, ace is the 1 in a deck of cards. Then you all, then 2 is snake, because I guess 2 looks like a snake. I think
it's snake eyes from dice.
That's what it was. Thank you.
Yeah,
that's what it was. 3 is san, as in for Japanese, you know, ichi ni san. And so on and so forth. So they all kind of have different. Clover is 4. I had the list of characters in front of me, and there they are. Junpei is he's 5, but he's called Junpei throughout the game because the number 6, the character Jun, gives away his name. And so he's the only one that's called by his real name for the longest time. 7 is just called 7 because he's not very creative. Lotus is 8, because I guess are there 8 petals on a lotus flower?
I think so, yeah. And June, I don't think you mentioned, because it's the 6th month.
Yes. Yeah. I did not mention. And then the 9th man, which you don't know. He doesn't make it very long, and we'll get into that. But the reason I said I was saying I don't think they necessarily coincide with the 9, like ace isn't a reformer, snake isn't a helper. Snake's kind of a helper. I would say he actually is very much a helper, but like the peacemaker, number 9, that's not number 9 in the game. In the slightest. But yeah, so that's all the little fun facts I was able to look up in terms of this. So I want to dive into this next, Kate. I want to kind of talk about the way the game tells its story, and listeners, I'm going to kind of put up a mild spoiler wall right here, because it'll be hard to talk about how the game plays without telling parts of its story, because they're very interconnected. It's a visual novel. The gameplay is the story practically. So I want to kind of start off and just hear from you, Kate. What are some of your favorite elements of the gameplay, whether it's the puzzles or how, or the branching dialogue paths or anything like that? So what are your thoughts?
Well, my background and my main interest, as I've mentioned, is games that do story in unique and interesting ways. And 999 is maybe one of the earlier examples of a game that I played that just blew me away with how it handled story. Because, I mean, branching dialogue has been a thing for a while, you know, since interactive fiction has existed, it's been a thing. But I feel like we only really started to see it pop up as a visual node-based flowchart relatively recently, like within the last 20 years. I don't have any evidence on that. I just feel like that's the case. If anybody wants to be like, actually, node-based flowcharts have been around for a long time, you idiot, then.
The
no,
only
I
thing I could
that.
Think of is like Zork, sort of, but I don't even know if you talked to anyone in Zork Zork's obviously a text adventure, but that'd be like the closest thing in my mind.
Yeah, or like choose your own adventure books, basically branching, and you could draw them out as a node-based flowchart if you wanted, and I'm sure people have. But within video games, like actually having that branching structure visible to the player, I think is quite unusual because it does sort of show people the framework of the game. But 999 leans into that. And actually, I'm curious, which version of the game did you play? Because it's out on a bunch of stuff.
I played it on the DS, the original version, or at least original in North. Oh, I guess it was original. I was thinking of like, because, you know, Phoenix Wright, the last episode I had you on, that was a Game Boy Advance game originally before it came over to DS. So no, this has always been. Yeah. So I played it on the DS.
Okay. Because there are some interesting, not issues, because that sounds bad, but there's some interesting things that the DS does that it was very much specifically made for that platform, which is another one of the interesting narrative tools. Mm-hmm. But the DS version also doesn't have a lot of improvements that later versions did have. And so I'm wondering how much you came up against that, because you probably wouldn't have known that like you were missing out on an improvement that they made, because you wouldn't have known that was the improvement if you're playing the original version. But anyway, getting into the weeds. So basically the DS screen, the double screen that it has, is a large part of the narrative. I think, let's see if I can remember this. The adventure part is on the bottom and the novel part is on the top. That might have been a post-DS thing. I don't remember, but
I did notice something like that. There was like the Junpei's out, like his spoken word was out, was on the top screen, and his inner thoughts were on the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's a very interesting. There's a few games that have sort of stood out to me because they've played with the actual format of the game on top of just the game itself. For example, what's the name? The House in Fata Morgana is a pretty straightforward visual novel, but at one point, you know, visual novels have logs, like here are all the words you've read up until this point. Like it plays with that. You open the log and there's like some words in there you don't recognize. And then you start to question what's going on. It's a very cool moment, you know, when a game plays with the format in a way you weren't expecting, it can lead to some really interesting plot twists. And 999 does that with the branching like structure of the game. And remind me, like the DS version, does it let you see the branches?
So what it does show you is that this is a good thing to talk about in terms of the gameplay, because this is a game you need to play multiple times to see. Bare minimum, you need to play it two times to get the true ending, bare minimum. So what I like though is that when you beat the game, you can see that there's six different endings, and whichever ending you get, that screen will like that. It's like it's three metal blocks or whatever with question marks on them, or maybe not even question marks, but like X's over them. And when you go to the one that has that you've completed, then it, you know, it's no longer this blocked out thing. You can see a little still image and it tells you which ending you got. And when you replay the game, you can actually fast forward through all the dialogue that you've already read. So it encourages you to replay it by not making you do the same thing in the same order. I do wish it would just let you fast forward to like the decision making spots, because then I'm just literally holding right on the D-pad for like 20 minutes as dialogue that I've already read four times at that point scrolls by.
But so I believe that that is one of the things that the DS version did not have. I could be wrong on this, but I'm relatively certain that later versions do let you skip, because otherwise it is impossible to actually complete the game. Did you get all the endings?
I got four out of the five.
Okay.
Or sorry, four out of the six. The two that I did not get, because there is there's the submarine ending. I should actually... I you know what? Let me bring up a list of endings so I make sure that I have it all. But there is the submarine ending. There is the knife ending. There is the axe ending. There is the coffin ending, which you can only get if you don't do the I jumped ahead. Coffin, submarine, knife, and axe. And then there is the safe ending. And the coffin ending you can only get if you didn't do the safe ending first. You have to do the coffin. Like, the coffin ending is just something where you can, if you, once you get the safe ending, you will never be able to get the coffin on that save file. Excuse me. You'd have to start over on a whole new save. So those 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, those are the main five. And then to get the hidden sixth ending, you have to do the safe ending first, and then you do another, you know, series, you know, make a different set of decisions, and you get to the final, the true ending. What I did on my first three playthroughs, I didn't look up any guides whatsoever, unless I got stuck on a puzzle or anything like that. By the fourth one, I'm like, I just want to know which doors to pick. I've done every puzzle at this point, so there's nothing. All that's left is just wasting time experimenting on which decisions to make where. Because the puzzles to me, like, I understand part of the gameplay is making those decisions, but if I have to wait 15 minutes in between just to make those decisions, I'm not going to. So I looked up a guide on how to get specific endings. I mentioned before in the beginning that I got the same ending twice initially.
Yeah,
that was the submarine ending where you know what? I already said spoiler, so I'm not going to worry too much about it right now. I'll put up a hard spoiler wall for when we get to the plot twist with the true ending. But that's the one where everyone is dead. You're walking through, everyone is dead. Like, you come out of somewhere and everyone's dead. And then June, the character, which Junpei and June actually have this kind of semi-romantic relationship. They're childhood friends, and it's very clear that June still likes Junpei, or June likes Junpei, and Junpei is kind of pervy towards June, and pervy towards everyone in some, like, in like small ways, but it's there. And you're walking out and everyone's dead and you see a submarine. I'm like, oh, am I going to survive? But I, like, everything I've loved is gone. Is that how this game's going to end? But fucking no, you get stabbed in the back and you drown in water with blood going everywhere.
Is that the one where you don't actually know who stabbed you?
Yes. You don't know who stabbed you. I know who it is now, but And that happened and I went, what the fuck? And the credits start rolling. I'm like, are you shitting me? And it made me so mad, but in, like, the best way.
Yes.
So then I'm like, I got to find out what this is. So I tried a different set of doors and I got the same ending. There's a moment in the game where you can choose between, I want to say it's like doors 6 and 8 or 3 or something like that. I'm going to have to double check specifically what that is. But you can choose between doors, like, yeah, it's gonna drive me. Oh, sorry, 3, 7, or 8. You can choose between doors 3, 7, or 8. And if you choose door 3, no matter what you did prior, you always end up with that submarine ending, because door 3 has some interesting. It'd be too into the weeds to explain why door 3 does that, but that's what ends up happening.
Yeah.
And I didn't do door 3. I'm like, well, I've already done 7. I think the game wants me to do, or I already did 8. I feel like if I just do 7, it's going to give me something similar again, because all the doors link up to each other. So let me just do 3 now that I know what happened after door 8. And it just gave me the same ending again. So I got extra mad at that.
Yeah. Do you think we can talk about, like, big spoilers yet? Because, like, you asked, you know, what are my favorite parts of the game? And a lot of them are, you know, related to things that are the end of the game.
Then what? Yeah, we can go into that. The last thing I think I want to talk about before we go into big spoilers, i.e. the true ending, is just how the game tells its story through the puzzles. So a lot of the themes, like I mentioned before, with the oh my gosh, I can't even freaking speak anymore. The morphogenetic fields, that a lot of that dialogue and that kind of thing is brought up almost at random, it feels like. I think that's one of the I like the dialogue overall, but all of his themes are not well like woven into the dialogue. It's like you'll be talking to someone and all of a sudden like, do you know about morphogenetic fields? And I'm like, what does this have to do with it? And then they also mention about the sunken Titanic. They talk a lot about the Titanic, which I do think actually works well because the ship that you're on looks like a replica of the Titanic sister is what you kind of find out. But that makes sense because like you're physically in the space. So it's like you could maybe make the argument, why does one of the characters know that? But the game does explain that. So I kind of give it off as a pass. But all the stuff about morphogenetic fields, it just feels very shoehorned in until you understand the ending. But even so, I still think the way it was written into the dialogue is a little rough, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of Uchikoshi's sort of trademark. He does it in the AI games as well, is just info dumps. It is just like, I can kind of relate because I get the feeling that Uchikoshi is somebody who has a lot of interests and really likes talking about them. And, you know, a lot of me and my friends are very similar. We will just info dump about our latest hyperfixation. And, you know, like one of mine right now is making quilts. I'm making a quilt. And if I was making a game, I would probably write a whole section where people just talk about how fun it is to make quilts together. And, you know, one of my friends is really into mushrooms, as I've already mentioned. And they will also tell me a lot about mushrooms. And I love it. I love hearing about other people's passions. And so I can kind of imagine Uchikoshi as this kind of person who's just like, oh, you guys, I really want to tell you about morphogenetic fields. And everyone's like, oh, what? Here we go again.
And you, he's like, and those fields.
It's really interesting. Like, we're all connected. Everyone's like, all right, you weird hippie. And then he's like, no, I'm going to make a game to explain it all. But I'm still going to have these sections where someone, like, you're in this life and death situation that has a time limit. And someone's like, you know what? Let me just tell you about this weird TV program I watched once about everybody looking at a picture of a dog.
Yes.
And it's like, okay. It's very much like Uchikoshi has all this like disparate information that he's managed to weave together into this incredible story about how brains are all connected. And it's utter pseudoscience bullshit in a lot of places. But I love being like, yeah, Uchikoshi, tell me more. Tell me more about morphogenetic fields and like all this other science bullshit that doesn't mean anything. I love it. Yes.
I feel like, I think pseudoscience stuff when it's woven into games are some of the most interesting because it's one of those things where it's like, since you don't actually hear people talk about it usually all that often, it makes you feel a lot smarter for listening to it. But there's still not a whole lot of science behind it, hence pseudoscience, which is I always find amusing. But the reason I was saying like these conversations about morphogenetic fields and all this stuff, the way it tells the story through that is, you know, there's a series of rooms that you have to escape from, and they have this, you know, very cinematic thing where you see Junpei get like some shifty eyes and it just says escape or whatever. It kind of turns into a small point and click adventure within the room itself, and you tap around the room, you find different items and objects. The game does a good job at not soft locking you because there's always other characters with you, and it's a little shoehorned in where sometimes a guy will like one character will randomly be like, hey, I don't think you should use that yet, and they never give a real reason why, which I'm not complaining about. I'd rather have like some kind of bizarre dialogue than get soft locked into a game that you spent like 40 minutes, like an hour or two into, and then have to watch all the dialogue again. I don't mind that so much, but a lot of the things that you do in the game will determine which of these six endings you get, depending on which characters you bring with you into the different puzzles, between which dialogue options you even have, you choose within those puzzles, between what you actually explore in the room to get the safe ending, which is, I think, why a good way to go into the big spoiler towards the end, to get the safe ending, you have to, in one of the rooms, you actually have to find a safe, like, you know, with a lock and, you know, a dial lock that you have to rotate and whatnot. you actually have to find a safe. And if you don't find that safe, even if you went through that room, if you don't open the door and look at the safe, you're not going to get the safe ending. So it encourages you to explore every aspect of the rooms in these puzzles. And I enjoy these puzzles because it's kind of like, I love escape rooms. My wife and I go to escape rooms with friends a lot. And this is kind of like a really fun point and click adventure version of that. It's a really well done puzzle thing. They're never too hard in my opinion, but they're just hard enough. And he talks about in the interview I mentioned before how the difficulty curve, if you're struggling with it, if you keep talking to a character, eventually they start giving you more and more hints. Mm-hmm. So you can make it as hard or as easy as you want, depending on how often you talk to the characters. And I don't have much more to discuss about the gameplay and puzzles. I feel like there's probably something I could sink my teeth into, but before we dive into the twist, the true ending and the big twist that you want to talk about, Kate, I want to hear from you. What are there any other things about the puzzles and gameplay that you would want to discuss before you can go off into the ending talk?
I mean, the puzzles are goofy. Like they're certainly puzzles, but they're just so weird. Like there's one that is, oh god, unless I'm mixing it up with Virtue's Last Reward, which I will do at some point. There's one that's about making cocktails. Is that right?
I think that might be in Virtue's Last Reward, unless I didn't get that puzzle. I'm pretty sure I played all of them.
Damn it. There's a lot of repeated characters in VLR, so it's very easy to get them mixed up. And it's similar. It's like doors with numbers and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And everyone has a bracelet on. So, like, they're very much similar games. Anyway, but the puzzles are roughly the same in VLR. So this still goes for 999 in that, like, some of the puzzles, you're like, who made this and why? It's like, what if the Saw movies were combined with, like, you know, an actual escape room where it's like, oh, you have to put this weird shaped object in this weird shaped hole and turn it exactly right. And then maybe a toaster will start speaking to you. And you're just like, sure, you know, okay, I'm fine with that.
Some of the weirder ones, there's one where you have like these two like test dummies where you remove body parts from them and swap them around, and you have to get them to weigh the same weight. And like some people's one, like the one body's heart, like artifact, like fake heart, it's obviously a dummy, but because it's used for like, I guess, surgical training or shit like that, or stuff like that. I don't quite know. There's a whole bunch of random shit thrown in all of these rooms, and it's very bizarre.
And usually it's just like a prompt for someone to start talking about the bloody morphogenetic fields again. It'll be like, whoa, this painting really reminds me of this story I once heard. Let's talk about it for 15 minutes. And you're like, yeah, all right. Sounds great.
I've heard you need to get out of the room,
but sure. Yeah, it's... I can't get enough of it. I love it so much.
I'd be lying if I said that I didn't enjoy it at least a little bit. It did get old. It definitely did get old, but I did enjoy all these like random things. Because once you get kind of, you have that suspension of disbelief and you just kind of allow the bizarre dialogue to happen, it makes the game so much more enjoyable. And it also gets you to know all the different characters, which I think is a good way to segue into the true ending. So this is a pretty hard spoiler wall, listeners. Like, we did some light spoilers beforehand, but now this is where, like, if you don't want to know the true ending, don't listen any further, because what I love about, or the true ending as well as some of the bigger twists or bigger, more spoilery stuff, I should say, what I love about the characters, as like you said, it gives characters an excuse to talk about some specific thing. You find out through the many playthroughs of this game that the notary game that you're forced to be a part of happened before. And every character that you're involved with, numbers 1 through 9, was involved in the original nonary game in some way, shape, or form. You aren't quite sure how you're related to it just yet, you, Junpei, but everyone has something to it. You find out that Lotus, the one that we were talking about before, where, you know, she's dressed she's dressed very provocatively, but she's, you know, her character's nothing like that. She's a mother. Her daughter was one of the original kids in this nonary game. And the whole idea of the nonary game was to test this concept of morphogenetic fields that we've been talking about now for like 45 minutes. And the idea of it was to, this experiment that these crazy people were running was that, they had two different groups of people, and there's one people basically they put both groups in this highly dangerous situation, and the one group was in Nevada and the other group was in the sinking ocean liner, and they had to the group up in Nevada would have to solve puzzles and then transmit, like, basically why am I blanking on the word, with just their mind, you know, telepathically, there we go, telepathically, all the way from whoever, wherever the ocean liner was, all the way over there, and get them and give the receiver the puzzle solution. And that was the whole purpose of the test. So Lotus's daughter was one of the kids involved in the test. It was involving a bunch of kids too, which makes it even more fucked up. Seven was a police officer who ended up tracking down and rescuing a lot of the kids from the original nonary experiment. June, you don't know exactly why she's part of it, but you will. I'll leave it to you, Kate, to kind of go into the crazy spoiler stuff. same with Junpei. Clover is the sister of Snake. You find out Snake is number two, Clover is number four, and Snake also participated in the original nonary game, as did Santa. And then Ace he's an interesting character to say the least. And he is tied into the original nonary game as well. So that's what I find is kind of cool. As you get to know these characters, you end this whole nonary game thing, because some of the characters obviously experienced this exact same thing before. It makes it so much more interesting for you as the player to start making all these connections as to how they are connected to each other, how they're connected to the nonary game, and what part does Zero, the person who's hosting this new nonary game, all have to play. I think I laid enough groundwork for that. So Kate, I'm sorry if I said anything that you wanted to dive into, but by all means, let's talk about it. Like, what do you got to say about this?
Okay. I mean, I mentioned before that the thing I like about 999 is the weird stuff it does with narrative. And to go deeper into that, it is a game with so many plot twists that you will never see coming, because they're so specific. So the point of the game, it explains this very early on, and it seems very overwhelming, that in order to go through a door, you have to have, I think, at least two people whose bracelet numbers add up to 9.
It's at least three, but no more than five.
No more than five. And if it's any fewer than three and any more than five, everyone explodes. Yep. So it's just like, don't worry about it. We're just not going to do that. Everyone has a bracelet with a number 1 through to 9 on it. And so it's all about this digital route. So basically, if you add 1 and 9, it makes 10. But then you have to add the 1 and 0, and it makes 1.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to just reduce it down until it's a single-digit number. And that sounds like it wouldn't work. And yet, it does. Even when people start dying, or like their bracelets fall off or whatever, it still manages to work out. And, you know, people are constantly like taking dead people's bracelets to like beep into a room, because it doesn't matter if it's three people, it just has to be three bracelets.
Yep.
So there's all these rules that like come out as you're playing. And then there's even more stuff where it's like, actually, it turns out a bunch of people's bracelets are not what they say they are.
Yep.
So like one person, you think they're a 6, they're actually a 9. And you're like, whoa, that changes everything, because the way that 9 works for this digital root thing is that it functions as a 0. You're basically a free player in any given like setup of people. A 9 functions as a 0. It doesn't add anything, which is weird that that's the way it works, but it means that you can get extra story out of it, because it's like, oh, this person can always go through whatever door they want to go through, but no one else knows that, mm-hmm. which is insane. The thing I mentioned earlier about the top screen being, I forget which way around it is. It's like the top screen is novel, the bottom screen is adventure mode.
Top screen, I don't know how you would classify it, but top screen was Junpei's speaking yeah. and bottom screen was his thoughts. So I would assume then top screen, that would make it novel and bottom screen adventure. Because you do,
I think so.
You make the choices on the bottom screen, which would be the adventure part. So I would assume that's correct.
So interestingly, what happens is in the novel section, which I think is the top screen, is that it every now and again will display a bunch of thoughts. And when you're playing the game, those seem like they are Junpei's thoughts.
Yes.
They're not. They're actually June's thoughts. The top screen is June's perspective. The bottom screen is Junpei's perspective. And you don't find that out until right at the end when it's suddenly like, oh, you're playing as two people in two different times playing the same game at the same time, but not at the same time because it's like
yeah.
9 years apart or something. So you have a whole different context for the entire game you've just played, where suddenly you're like, wait, that wasn't me. Every time I was making a decision, it was the bottom screen. And every time I was thinking, it was the top screen, but it wasn't me thinking. And it's just like, whoa. And it's incredible how they managed to do all of that, plus all the weird math stuff. There's also a bunch of twists about hexadecimal.
Yes.
Which is like, so it's like, oh, well, if everybody is number 1 to 9, you assume that everything's working in base 10. But it turns out, no, everything's base 16 and has been the whole time. And
yep.
you're like, wait, what? No, I don't even know what hexadecimal is. What are you talking about?
A lot of stuff coders use, not people, not exactly. normies.
So you think that like someone is a 0. It turns out they're an O because hexadecimal goes into letters.
Yep.
And oh man, and it manages to, it sounds very stressful and very math heavy, but somehow you absolutely are able to follow along with all of this. Like Uchikoshi is a very particular man with very particular interests, but he's a damn good writer, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And like, I think 999 is a very good game, but I think VLR, the sequel, is even better, but only because it's building on what 999 sets up.
So, I do have that game as well. I have it for my Vita.
Have you played it?
No, I you know what? I will have to have you back on for that one as well.
Okay. Good. I'll get them mixed up again, so that'll be fun.
Real quick before you continue on, echo what you were saying about how all this math stuff sounds confusing, but it's not in the game. You're 100% right. I think the way Uchikoshi does that is that specifically with the digital root stuff and all that math, you might have to solve some of it for puzzles within the escape rooms, but all the doors, that's all done through just dialogue. You don't have to do any math at all. They have yes. the characters do the math, so it still gives you that sense of yeah. discovery because you're discovering it with the characters, but it doesn't actually make you do the math. So it does all the legwork for you while making you feel like you participated in it, which I think is really genius.
Yes. Some of the puzzles are very hard. That's okay though, mm-hmm. because like you say, most of it is kind of handled for you. But yeah, some of the puzzles are tricky. And especially if you're playing the DS version, which doesn't let you skip the text. Like, oh, nope. Yeah, it's not the best way. It is the best way to play the game because you get the dual screen thing, but it's also not the best way to play the game because you can't skip the text. So, yeah.
I mean, you can up until it's a spot that you haven't done before, but you can't skip. Mm. You can skip the text in puzzles as well, but you can't skip mm-hmm. entire puzzles that you've already done before.
Right. But when you say skip the text, you're just like fast forwarding.
Oh, yeah. You're fast forwarding. Yeah,
not
I guess
just
you're
entirely skipping it.
Yeah.
I guess is nice, but it's not nice enough.
No, I'm with you because that's what makes it a little bit frustrating to play in retrospect. Now, I will say, because I do see we're starting to run low on time, so I want to I want to keep to our time limit on this. In that plot twist, like you said, June is the one that's actually telepathically communicating with you. But what's strange is that there's two things that happened when I got to that moment. I do think it works overall, but when you first find out that it's June telepathically communicating with you, because in the Nonary game, 9 years prior, June is part of the original Nonary game and she's stuck in an incinerator. And the way she gets out is that she uses her telepathic powers to talk to Junpei 9 years in the future. For him. And so the whole purpose of the second Nonary game is that when June survives it, she knows she needs to do all this in 9 years and get Junpei there so that way she can go on and survive it. Because if she doesn't get Junpei in that situation 9 years later on, she's dead. The younger version of her is dead and then she never would exist. What bugged me a little bit about it, I thought they had a really interesting opportunity to be like, because the game, since it's talking about morphogenetic fields and telepathy and all this other stuff, like transmissions, information transmissions over time, the way the game plays with the multiple endings, replaying stuff that you already know, the game memorizing which endings and which dialogue you've already done, plays into that theme really well, because it's the idea of that you're like, you, the player, are transmitting this information to the character of Junpei. Really cool idea. But when it gets to the big plot twist, when Junpei, like, because it leads up to it where Junpei's like, why do I know this? Why do I know this already? How do I know this already? And it would have been so much cooler if it was like breaking, I shouldn't say cooler, interesting, if they were breaking the fourth wall and you were the person with the thoughts or something like that. And I thought that's where they were going with it. I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. Like, including the player in the narrative by making them the person, like, telepathically using the morphogenetic fields that they talk about in the game to transmit the information to the character in the game. That's where I thought they were going with that. And then they did it, and they did it with June. And I'm like, okay, I don't like that as much. But then once you get to the whole thing, you find out that it's like this time loop, you know, and June has to do this because it's the past version of her going and getting information from the future Junpei and all these other crazy, like, Terminator-esque time travel bullshit. I didn't mind that as much, but I still think it would have been a cooler idea, a more ballsy idea to try to make the player, them, like you, the player, the person transmitting the morphogenetic shenanigans to Junpei, you know?
Like a meta sort of layer of narrative. Yeah, I mean, honestly, the thing I come away from when I think about the narrative in 999, the thing I come away from that game thinking is, how the hell did he keep all of this in his head? Like, I have struggled with normal branching narratives, like writing them down and keeping track of where everything's going. And this is so much more complicated than that. I don't know how you would even write something like this. I don't know where you would start.
And imagine, I actually remember talking to you last year about this in passing, localization. Imagine localizing this.
I was going to mention that, and I was like, no, that's getting too far into it.
No, but yeah, it's not far enough. Absolutely.
I mean, there are a lot of very interesting one-off localization choices in this game that I probably couldn't recall right now. There's a lot of puns, and puns are the hardest thing to translate.
Yes,
there's a lot of number stuff, and numbers are, like, relatively hard to translate. Numbers don't mean the same things necessarily in every language. Like, the numbers themselves do, but the numbers' meaning might change. Mm-hmm. And so even their nicknames, like having someone be like, oh, I'm gonna be Clover, like, in some countries a clover is three leaves, in others it's three or four, you know. Mm-hmm. So things like that, like, it's all very clever for a game that's like old. How old are we talking? When did that, like,
999 came out 2009.
So, okay, it's not as old as I thought it was, but still, like, localization wasn't quite as well set up back then. And, like, it obviously, localization has been going for a long time, but localization is still an industry that's figuring out a lot of stuff. I was having a conversation today about changing inline information, like words that are in the middle of a sentence. and how that is easy in English, but very hard in a gendered language because you have to change a bunch of other words in the sentence.
And so
word order is very different. So you can't necessarily have something in the middle of a sentence because German might put it at the end of the sentence, for example. And we still don't really have good solutions for a lot of those things within localization. And so to see a game from, like, I don't want to do the maths, like 15 years ago-ish.
Yeah, 14, almost 14.
Okay. 40, we'll say 15. It's nice. Yeah, basically. Round.
Decade and a half.
15 years ago when localization was even less advanced, and they've managed to translate it in a way that I think still maintains probably a lot of what was in the Japanese. I've never played it in the Japanese. I don't speak Japanese, so that's probably never going to happen. But I've read a lot about the localization of this game, and I wish I had more specifics off the top of my head, but it is an incredibly ambitious and impressive project to translate into any language, let alone from Japanese and English, which are two very different languages.
Yes,
like culturally, historically, grammatically, they're very, very different. And I think it all came from the fact that 999, I don't think it was very successful in Japan when it came out, but it was in North America. So they were sort of like, oh, well, okay, guess we'll make another one then. And maybe with the other ones, they thought more about localization. I don't know. I don't know who localized it, but if they're listening, you did a great job. Seriously.
They really did. Because the jokes all work. It, like, localization's hard, and I was about to tell an anecdote about, because I had Jeremy Blaustein on the show before, but I remembered last time I had you on, I either was on mic or off mic, I think I told the anecdote, so I'm going to save it here. But one thing that he has been really pushing for, and I believe I said it last time as well, but this is worth repeating. Mm-hmm. Localizers don't get enough credit for being, they should be considered as writers, not just translators.
Yeah, absolutely.
And because you never think about it that way. And I can use his anecdote as an example of why you need a localizer, not just a translator, because he worked on Pokemon, and mm-hmm. there was a moment where they were doing a pun, and it was like, instead of Pikachu, it was Pimanchu, and Pimanchu means like, it was, I end up going to, if it was translated literally, it would mean like steak chew, steak. And obviously steak chew is not a pun. Pimanchu from Pikachu in Japanese, I can see the pun just in terms of like the play of words there. Mm-hmm. But like steak chew makes no fucking sense in English. So he told the story about how he went to his boss and he's like, this won't work. How do you, like, what type of joke do you want me to include here to keep your intent, like, as close to the original as possible? And they're like, just translate it. Shut up and translate. And he got mm-hmm. really mad about that, and he got fired for that.
Yeah.
But it was a funny story, but I don't blame him for being mad when you care that much about your work and you want to do a good job. Like, steak chew's not a joke. That's not going to make anybody laugh. It makes us laugh because it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's not a joke, but.
Yeah. I think a lot of what localization does, and like, I'm not just talking out my bum with this because I do have a degree in Latin and ancient Greek, which are almost entirely about translation. Mm-hmm. When you study another language, it's about speaking it with other, you know, fluent and learning speakers. But with Latin and ancient Greek, you are almost entirely just interpreting someone's words. And so you learn a lot about the art of translation. I did my dissertation on translation as well. So I know so much. Well, I used to anyway. And what you do is you just this sort of like displacement of jokes. So you can't always have the joke in exactly the same place because it requires, especially if it's like a play on words or a pun or anything like that, it requires an exact like equivalent in the language you're translating into. Mm-hmm. And that usually is not going to be the case because puns arise from culture in a lot of senses. So you end up being like, okay, well, there was a joke here, but we can't do it in exactly the same place. So we'll put it somewhere nearby so that the player still gets a sense of like, this is a comedic scene. And that takes so much talent to be able to not only recognize where there is a joke, because it's not always obvious when something is a joke, in Japanese, for example, you might read it and not see the wordplay or not have the cultural context to know that it is wordplay. And then to see that, to pick up on that, and then make a new one with someone else's words and still keep the sense of what is happening in that scene. That is incredibly hard to do. Obviously I did it in Latin, which has the other layer of like, we don't even know if some of those sentences are jokes because they might have been referring to something that we wouldn't pick up on because we don't know.
It's any a dead of language.
We weren't there. They might be referring to a politician that no one now would recognize. And so it's not always clear what the jokes are. And like, I think you can have that with modern languages too. You can have somebody making a joke that is accent related. That happens a lot in localization. I think it also happens in 999 where, you know, people have very specific Japanese accents that imply something about their culture, their background, where they're from.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to think of a way to translate that into English. And there are a few examples of games that do it really well. The Yakuza games, I haven't played, but I hear that they do very interesting things with accents.
Mm-hmm.
And Ni no Kuni is very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it has all these different Japanese accents and it goes, what if it was Welsh? And like Welsh, I don't think has any direct analog in Japan, but it means something very specific to at least British people. I don't think Welsh means quite as much to people in North America because it's not a very common accent to hear in like pop culture.
No, it's not. And I only even knew Welsh was an accent because I'm a James Bond fan and Timothy Dalton was Welsh. I think he was Welsh.
Yes. Oh, that's great. I don't have any like specific examples in 999, but you have characters like Seven, who he looks like a sort of trucker, you know, you're expecting that kind of accent out of him. And I think he does speak a little bit like that. And then Ace looks like more of an older professional man. And so you're expecting him to speak a certain way. And that would come across differently in Japanese than it does in English. And so you have to understand all of that. And absolutely, I think localizers should be writers as well. They should be credited as writers because they end up doing so much creative work. It is not just translating, which is hard in itself. It is this mm-hmm. very creative interpretation and rebuilding of a story, which I could never do. I'm so in awe of localization teams. I think they're cool.
When I had Jeremy Blaustein on, he was beating the drum about that same. I mean, that's where he's been trying to fight for that for so long. And one of the things he talks about, I know this is kind of a bit of a tangent off of 999, but I'm enjoying this localization chat. but one of the things that he beats the drum about was that when you localize something, you need to get a native speaker to do the localization because mm-hmm. it's not just enough that you like he says, like, I know Japanese. I would never localize a game from English into Japanese mm-hmm. because I don't, as much as I have lived, he was saying, I'm paraphrasing what he said, but as much as he has lived in Japan for years now, that's still not the same as growing up there. That's still not the same as knowing the culture from there and vice versa for any culture that a game gets translated or any game gets localized into. And so in I don't know how new or old his company is, but Dragon Baby is his localization company. Mm-hmm. Actually, I should follow up with him because when I had him on the show, he was talking about he was working on a dream project. And I don't know what came of that. I haven't followed. I'll have to follow up with him on that. But he talks about how they've tried to hire a lot of people from all over the world. So that way, when they localize a game into whatever region that is, that person can do the best possible job in doing so. Because they know all the culture. And to bring it back to 999, it's such a great localization because like you were saying, Ace is like this kind of sophisticated businessman. I got that just from the dialogue. There's very little audio in the DS version. I'm seeing on the wiki that there were full voice actors for, I'm assuming, later releases.
I only ever listened to the Japanese ones because I think they're really well done.
Mm.
but I think we did play around with the English voiceover and it was like, no, don't like it. But not because it's bad. It's just, I think the Japanese one has so much character. And I was used to the Japanese voices. So I was like, oh, who are these weird people that I don't know voicing these characters that I like? So it's good.
I might have to look up some of the examples. Because like I said, on the DS version, they don't have any of these voice actors on it. So I other than just hearing a, huh? or something like that, just a grunt or like a just a little sound bite, you don't really hear any performances. It's just kind of, you know, random grunts like that. But to speak about the localization again with it, and then we'll wrap up, is the, like, every character, it was so well localized that you can tell the type of character just from their dialogue. It doesn't feel like just a translation of, like, here's what Snake is saying, or here's what Santa is saying, or here's what Lotus is saying. It is very much like they do such a good job of kind of finding mannerisms and quirks within the dialogue to make them feel more like a character and not just a translation. And they kind of apply, it almost feels like they're like, well, this is how someone would say this in the US or North America, but now this is how Lotus would say this as an American, type of thing.
Yeah.
And I think it's just really, really excellently localized. One last thing before we go into final thoughts, because we are running long on time. One of the other big plot twists that we forgot to talk about is just some of the people who ran the original Nonary game are in the cast of characters in this. Ace, number one, he was the CEO of the company that basically, I forget what, it's a pharmaceutical company. I'm blanking on the name of it.
Cradle Pharmaceutical?
I think you're right. I think it's Cradle. He was the CEO who headed up the Nonary game. And when he gets found out, he goes fucking crazy. He's terrifying. He's the dude that stabs you in the back in the submarine ending. The ninth man that we mentioned, how he doesn't last long. He was, I believe, the chief technical officer, one of the other higher ups in Cradle Pharmaceutical. And he was promised by Ace, because Ace knows exactly what's going on at the beginning, and he's promised by Ace in the beginning, like, oh, this, you know, this doesn't work the same way that we ran it, so just go through the door and come back and get me later, blah, blah, blah. And he did that to test out how real it was, and the ninth man exploded right in the beginning. And you meet another character who ends up getting, he got an axe in the back, and he was one of the other higher ups. It's all over the place. It's kind of wild. There's like four major higher ups that were involved in the original Nonary game, and they all get killed in some way, shape, or form at the end of this game. And you find out as you escape that you're actually on the tanker in Nevada, like the fake one. There is no chance of anyone actually dying from drowning. It was all part of the plan, which I thought was a really fun plot twist. So I just wanted to talk about those last couple bits. So Kate, any final thoughts on the story that we went into, and then if there's none on that, just final thoughts on the game itself?
Well, my final thoughts are actually not technically related to the game itself, but that anybody who has enjoyed playing 999, listening to us talk about 999, or just thinks that they want to jump in, I would 100% recommend playing Virtue's Last Reward. Now, I played Virtue's Last Reward first, which is not the way I would recommend doing it. It is easier to get hold of a copy of VLR, or at least it was at the time. And these days you can buy the Nonary game bundle, which is both games. You can buy it on PC or on Switch or maybe PlayStation. I don't know. Maybe. No, you can get it on Xbox as well. It's everywhere. So I wouldn't recommend starting with VLR like I did, because it won't make a lot of sense. But I think that the duo of games is incredible. Now, there is a third game. It is a trilogy. I don't know if I can wholeheartedly recommend the third one, which is called Zero Time Dilemma. I own two copies of it, and I did a review of it. You can read my review. I forget where it is. I think maybe The Guardian. If you want to know my thoughts on it, you can read that and you'll be like, oh, this game sounds bad. but it does continue the story. The trilogy is one continuous story. It has a lot of repeating characters. You'll be like, oh, it's that guy again. It has a lot of repeating themes. Get ready to hear about the morphogenetic field.
Oh, I'm excited.
A whole bunch of times and various spin-offs of that theory. But I think it's those two games, I think, are just perfect as they are. And if you want more, you can play Zero Time Dilemma. It's mostly just that it's kind of ugly. And also Uchikoshi's other newer games, the AI series, which so far has two games, is also very good and has a lot of the same tropes, which is like young girls being perved on by people. but Uchikoshi is also very like pro-LGBT, and I think that that is really nice to see.
That's awesome.
In his games. Like, it only comes out every now and again, but it comes out, you know? And so that just makes me love him even more. Like, to my knowledge, Uchikoshi hasn't done anything where I'm like, okay, never mind, you know? He seems like a pretty cool dude who has a lot of very hyper-specific interests that he will talk your ear off about, but they're great, you know? He's an interesting guy, and I really, really recommend that anybody who thinks that this sounds like their jam, who is interested in weird narratives, who's interested in, you know, like, honestly, a masterclass in plot twists, that at the very least, check out 999. You'll probably find it most easily as part of the Nonary Games bundle anyway, so you could play both. Yay! And yeah, I want to know what you think. So you could tell me on Twitter.
if it's still alive, you know.
If Twitter's still alive, yeah, we'll see.
I for my final thoughts, I'm with you on that. And I, to be honest, what originally, so I bought the game on a whim. It was one of those ones where I knew it was a DS game going up in value. I'm not a reseller, but I am a collector, so I do like to add games to my collection, but I also don't like to break the bank. So I'm like, well, this game is still $50 or $60. So while that is expensive for a DS game from 2009, a lot of these games are only going to go up. So I want to get this now because I've been wanting to play it, and it did not. It did not disappoint. I really did enjoy this game. I think we didn't talk about it much, and that's fine. The art style is very anime. It is anime, and it's really good. It works for the game. But what captivated me, to buy the game in the first place was just the visual of the person in the gas mask, and you just see like 999 and almost like. You ever see that movie Seven with like Brad Pitt? Almost looks like the yes. font from that. So it's really like just the visuals right there are very striking. It really it makes your imagination start wondering like, why does this 999 look creepy? Why is there a person in a gas mask? Like the visuals alone just really suck you in. And so then I put it up on the patron poll, really, the patrons voted on it. And I just enjoyed getting to experience this finally. And it's a well-written story. It's worth checking out. I know for those, if you're this far into the podcast and you have not played the game and we've spoiled all of it for you, well, A, that's your fault, but B, still play it. Because we didn't spoil any of the puzzles. The puzzles are still fun. They're goofy, they're bizarre, and the dialogue is throughout it is still interesting. So I do also highly recommend this game. And trust me, I don't always end up getting to wreck it. Like not all the games that I end up playing for the show I end up enjoying. So that's all I got to say about 999. So let's wrap up this episode. Kate, thank you so much for joining me on this episode. I'm so happy to have you back on the show after about a year since you were on the Phoenix Wright one. So to close us out, where can the good people find you online, and is there anything you would like to promote?
Actually, for once, I kind of do have something to promote. I am currently the writer for a game called Moonstone Island.
Ooh.
I'm also the community manager for until the game comes out, at least. So I'm doing a lot of the social stuff. And so the writing is almost done. And so I've transitioned into community managing, which means just posting pictures and like, you know, recordings of the game and being like, look how cool this game is that mm-hmm. I made. I'm not the only developer, but I am the only writer. And so it's been a lot of fun and a lot of work. And I really hope that people enjoy it. It's a sort of Stardew Valley meets Pokemon is how we're kind of pitching it. And you get to do farms and go on dates and fly around and make potions and fight little critters with a deck building aspect, which sounds like a lot, but it's all really good. And I know people always say that about the games they're making, but it's genuinely very good. So you can check that out. You can follow, I think it's Moonstone_game on Twitter. I'm running mm-hmm. the Twitter, so it's me. And if you want to follow actual me, I'm also on Twitter at @HowNotToDraw. I'm also on Instagram at @HowNotToDraw. My Twitter is more game stuff and dumb jokes. And my Instagram is a lot of food,
which always sounds really boring. I see that in your stories a lot, all the different things you're cooking.
Cooking is like my main hobby. And I have a lot of really specific kitchen equipment. Like I have a meat grinder now, which is stupid and not a thing that anybody needs. But so hopefully that convinces people that my Instagram isn't just like, wow, here's some egg I ate this morning. It's like, it's more fun than that, I think. I think that's it. I think that's where I am mostly.
I enjoy seeing the cooking stuff. It's something my wife and I have recently started doing more of on our own. Like we would always cook, but like we recently got those every plate meals because the problem is we never know what to cook. That's the main issue. So being able to pick from like, this is not a sponsor. I swear to God, listeners, they're not paying me a single thing. But it's been fun. So like tonight I made balsamic glazed meatballs with the roasted green beans, and there was like garlic butter ciabatta bread.
Very nice. Yeah, wow.
It was fun.
I love those meals. I save like all the recipes and then pretend I came up with them myself.
I feel like you could make a collage out of them. You get so many of those freaking cards.
Yeah. Yes.
But
I have a lot.
All right. So for my stuff, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. If you want to email me, you can email me stillloadingcontact@gmail.com. If you want to support the show, you can do so in a number of ways. You can give it a 5-star rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or, you know, whichever podcasting app you use, because that makes me feel warm and fuzzy. And, you know, I like feeling warm and fuzzy. You can also support the show over on Patreon. If you throw a couple bucks my way for $1 a month, you'll get the episodes a few days earlier with better audio quality, as well as patron voting rights, which is how this episode happened. So if you want to help guide more episode topics for the show, go over to patreon.com/stillloadingpod. And for as little as $1, you can get voting rights for the quarterly polls. For $4 a month, you get everything at the previous tier, as well as access to too many bonus episodes every month. And then for $5 a month, you'll get everything in the previous two tiers, plus access to Still Bonding, which is my monthly James Bond podcast where me and some friends bond over 007. And those episodes are 2.5 to 3.5 hours long. So at this point, you're getting like 15 to 20 hours worth of content if you subscribe at the $5 level. So all of that, patreon.com/stillloadingpod. But of course, the most important shout out is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of kids receiving inpatient care at hospitals. So if you want to support them, go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating. That is all the time I have for you today. Kate, thank you once again for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
And that will do it for this episode, and I will see you all next time.